World at 6. Good evening. From CBC News Toronto, this is Earl Cameron with George Rich. Here are the headlines. President Nixon says he will hand over the Watergate tapes to a federal judge. Oil, the federal minister of energy, meets with his American counterpart in Ottawa, and tariffs are removed from refined petroleum products. Fighting rages again on all Mideast fronts. At the UN, another Russo-American resolution to bring about a ceasefire. And Uncle Max tells a fairy story. Now the details, George.
The President of the United States is turning over his Watergate tapes to a federal court judge.
The President, on Friday, made what he thought, Attorney General Richardson thought, what I thought, was a very reasonable proposal to accommodate the spirit of the court's order with the least intrusion of presidential confidentiality and bring a constitutional crisis to an end. It was obvious that the constitutional crisis was not over, that even if, as I hope he would have, Judge Sirica had accepted the presentation that we had planned to make as satisfactory compliance, there would have been those who would have said that the president is defying the law. This president does not defy the law.
The announcement was made by Charles Allen Wright, the president's main courtroom lawyer in the Watergate affair, amid resignations in the Justice Department and moves in the House of Representatives toward impeachment. The timing of the announcement has thrown Washington into confusion, as the many elements of the interrelated affairs vie for attention and then are quickly overshadowed by another development.
We'll come back to the impeachment calls and the Justice Department resignations in a moment, but first, to try to put the tapes decision in perspective, here's Ken Mason in Washington.
The abrupt change in the presidential stance came as a shock to scores of spectators who crammed Chief Judge John Sirica's second-floor courtroom in the U.S. District Court building. They were waiting to hear the judge's response to the president's proposal to summarize the tapes and have the summary verified by a senior senator. Instead, Mr. Nixon's lawyer, Charles Allen Wright, told the court the tapes would be turned over. Observers here are saying the president's decision will probably lessen any sentiment in Congress to go ahead with impeachment proceedings. In any event, House Speaker Carl Albert has decided that all impeachment resolutions will be referred to the House Judiciary Committee for preliminary investigation, and that in itself is a time-consuming operation. The first impeachment resolution was introduced by Democratic Representative Jerome R. Waldy of California. He said later today he intends to proceed. Among other things, he says he wants to know whether the president intends to release certain White House documents which were requested by Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox before he was fired. And that would appear to be the heart of this latest crisis, the special Watergate prosecutor's refusal to accept the Nixon compromise if it would prevent him digging for evidence beyond what may be on the White House tapes. The feeling here is that Mr. Nixon may have misjudged the reaction of his Attorney General, Elliot Richardson, and the Deputy Attorney General, William Ruckelshaus. The theory is that Mr. Cox was the only one the president wanted to dismiss, that Mr. Richardson and Mr. Ruckelshaus were accidental victims caught in the crossfire with no choice but to resign over the principle of maintaining an independent investigation. The word of Mr. Nixon's decision to release the tapes came just as Mr. Ruckelshaus was holding his own news conference this afternoon. He said that perhaps the public outcry of the past few days has evoked a response. And applauds the president's action, he said there must be a continuing independent investigation to head off a developing crisis of confidence. Ken Mason, CBC News, Washington.
At a White House briefing on today's decision, which ended a short time ago, it was announced that President Nixon will address the nation tomorrow night. He's expected to give his version of the tapes decision. Also at the briefing, White House advisors Alexander Haig and Charles Allen Wright said they'd misjudged the impact of the president's decisions on Archibald Cox, precipitating the crisis they'd sought to avoid. Mr. Haig also noted that international factors pressing on the White House had played a key role in making the tape decision.
The president's decision to turn over the Watergate tapes won't, it would seem, forestall the several impeachment resolutions that are underway. The House today sent to the Committee on the Judiciary those resolutions seeking to expel Mr. Nixon, and the committee chairman, Peter Rodino, said he felt there was little choice but to proceed. And he added they'll also be dealing with various independent proposals for an independent Watergate prosecution with all relevant evidence.
As chairman of that committee, I will immediately initiate consideration of appropriate procedures for handling all such resolutions and related legislation and for the conduct of appropriate inquiries. These procedures also involve such questions as the integrity of pertinent files. In this respect, I have written Acting Attorney General Bork asking for immediate assurance that the special prosecutor's files will be preserved.
The news of the tape's concession has also tended to overshadow two other events in the American Capitol today, news conferences by the former Attorney General and his deputy. Elliot Richardson and Williams Ruckelshaus were forced out of office by the president's decision to sack the special Watergate prosecutor. First, Mr. Richardson explained his reasons for resigning.
First, let me say that as a private citizen, I'm grateful to the acting Attorney General, Mr. Robert Bork, for allowing me the use of the hall. There can be no greater privilege, and there is no greater satisfaction than the opportunity to serve one's country. I shall always be grateful to President Nixon for giving me that opportunity in several demanding positions. Although I strongly believe in the general purposes and priorities of his administration, I have been compelled to conclude that I could better serve my country by resigning my public office than by continuing in it. This is true for two reasons. First, because to continue would have forced me to refuse to carry out a direct order of the president. Second, because I did not agree with the decisions which brought about the necessity for the issuance of that order.
Echoing the Richardson statement, both in tone and in the reasons for the decision to quit, the former Deputy Attorney General, William Ruckelshaus, also had a grim warning.
As proof, in my mind, that the crisis of confidence in this country is serious, I have found in recent months, traveling around America, that people are taking two reactions. One is that they're dropping out of the political process altogether. They're giving up on it. That apathy is taking over. And secondly, the almost hysterical reaction to what happened over the last few days has indicated to me that we may run the risk of having a reaction on the other side of people taking to the streets.
Meanwhile, the Senate Watergate Committee continued its fight for the Watergate tapes, requesting the U.S. Court of Appeals for a reversal of a decision which dismissed the committee's suit to obtain them.
The problems of sharing vital energy resources. In Ottawa, the Federal Minister of Energy met today with high-ranking American officials to discuss U.S. needs and Canadian supplies. As that meeting ended, an opposition member of Parliament said he had learned that tankers carrying oil from the Middle East to Canada had been diverted to American ports.
First, the all-day meeting between the Minister of Energy and top American officials, including John Love, President Nixon's special advisor on energy matters. The two men agreed to establish official task forces to study joint energy problems. After the meeting, Governor Love told newsmen, the U.S. is satisfied at the present time with the level of Canadian oil exports. The governor noted that Alberta now supplies about 1.2 million barrels of crude oil to the U.S. every day.
I do not believe that on the basis of the current emergency that there are any particular ways that this could or perhaps should be increased very materially. But in the longer term, I have little doubt that there are energy resources in Canada, the development of which would be to the advantage both of Canada and the United States on a basis in which portion of them would serve to go to United States markets.
Mr. McDonald, the energy minister, was asked if Ottawa is aiming at a full-scale continental energy policy.
We are faced with, in the next decade, with making some important decisions with regard to major energy developments in Canada, and one of our objectives will be to define the extent to which these will fit the energy priorities in the United States. And what, if any, the relationship should be between the American demand and possible Canadian supply.
As the energy minister was speaking, Lauren Nystrom of the New Democrats told newsmen Canadian oil on the high seas is being diverted to the United States.
Mr. Nystrom, what proof do you have that these tanker companies, in fact, are diverting oil away from Canada?
Well, we have a contact that was in contact with their offices in New York, the offices of Texaco and Imperial Oil. And apparently this person told my contact that these companies have diverted six tankers that were destined to Canada from the Middle East to the United States to refineries in that country. And that amounts to some 3.5 million barrels of oil, or the equivalency of about 1 week's supply to eastern Canada.
What do you think the government should do about it right away?
Well, there are two things they could do. Number one is they should investigate it, but after that, they can either exercise some kind of sanctions against the multinational corporations. They get oil in our country. We could penalize them in some way. Or secondly, we could cut off some of our exports to the United States.
If this oil destined for Canada was stolen, as you put it, how was it actually done? Did the tankers leave the Middle East ports destined for Canada and suddenly switch their direction midstream?
My understanding is they left the Middle East destined to Canada, and then they got orders from their headquarters, possibly in New York, that they should go to American ports instead of Canadian ports. And this is just another example of the power of a multinational corporation that are really sovereign states that don't pay attention to national boundaries. And it's really just a shifting of their inventory from one country to another, regardless of what the needs or the commitments to a consumer of one country may have been.
Do you think that if this was to continue unchecked, that it would be a critical situation for eastern Canada?
Very critical, because if I were the Arabs, I think the first thing I would do would be to cut off oil supplies to Canada if our country is going to allow oil destined to our country to go to the United States, because they've already cut off oil to the U.S. And if that practice is to go on, I think the Arabs would have no choice politically but to do that. And then where do we get our oil from? You know, 45% of our oil, I understand, that is imported, comes from the Middle East countries. And if that happens, then we are in trouble until we extend the pipeline to Montreal and transport Western oil to the Montreal market, which, of course, is the long-term solution.
Thank you very much.
The federal government has acted to reduce the price of imported petroleum products. John Turner, the Minister of Finance, announced today that import duties on incoming shipments of gasoline, heating oils, and diesel and aviation fuels will be removed starting tomorrow. With the details, Terry Hargraves in Ottawa.
Mr. Turner tabled the necessary parliamentary paperwork today. Parliament will be asked to approve the move, but it does come into effect tomorrow. Mr. Turner's statement said that the action is being taken to help offset rising prices for petroleum products, and the savings resulting from the elimination of duties should be of benefit to consumers. The duty collected, however, only amounted to 0.33 per gallon to 1 cent a gallon. And last year, the total duty collected amounted only to about $4 million. So the saving, at best, will be marginal. Heavy fuel oils have been free of duty under a temporary provision, and that will be extended, along with the new moves, to a period of 2 years. Crude oil coming into Canada to Canadian refiners has been duty-free for many years. The cut in duty on gasoline, heating oils, diesel, and aviation fuels is expected only to slow marginally the continual climbing prices of imported fuels. Terry Hargreaves, CBC News, Ottawa.
Meanwhile, Canadian oil companies with refineries in Montreal have begun shipping oil from Western Canada to their Montreal plants. The oil is being moved by Lake Tanker from ports in Ontario. The spokesman for Gulf, one of the companies involved, says rising foreign prices have now made it almost as cheap to ship Alberta crude to Montreal as it is to import it from Venezuela and the Middle East.
The prices of Ontario natural gas may rise soon if the producers have their way. A number of companies have warned they'll be forced out of business if they're unable to get more money for their product. The companies, which produce about 4% of the natural gas used in Ontario, say they're receiving considerably less than Western producers. With more on the story, here is Paul Griffin in Toronto.
George Chilian is president of New Metal Ore Mining Company, the largest producer of natural gas in Ontario. Mr. Chilian says Ontario utility companies are paying him 42 cents per 1,000 cubic feet, while they pay Western producers 9 cents more. He says his gas is superior in quality, with less sulfur content and water. Mr. Chilian says his company has over 40 years of proven undrilled reserves, but it cannot afford to tap them because of low prices. He believes that Union Gas, his largest customer, may be putting a squeeze on him by making it difficult for his company to continue exploration while at the same time buying up adjacent property to his wells. The answer, he believes, is a government prices review board similar to that in Alberta, whereby the producer is guaranteed a fair price for his product. Otherwise, he'll be out of business.
We're not seeking a price increase strictly because of all the publicity about the price of energy going up and that kind of thing. We're seeking a price increase, and not only because of the fact that There's an inequity right now between imported and domestic supplies. We need a price increase because 9 years ago, when we started here in the province drilling wells, we paid $35, for example, for a 3-inch valve. That same valve costs us today $130. We just can't keep up with the spiraling inflation without having a very substantial increase in the price for in order for us to go ahead and start drilling again.
Ontario's Minister of Energy, Darcy McHugh, says the government is considering the establishment of a task force to examine the problem of the Ontario producer.
They feel, some of them feel, that they need a higher price from the Ontario utilities or from the oil companies to justify the mining of that resource. Now, whether it can be justified or not is something that we want to take a look at. But we are not, what I said today was that we're not indifferent to the complaints, which some of them have. How legitimate they are is something we want to find out about. So what we're thinking about is, we haven't firmed our thinking up on this yet, is a task force to look at how we can optimize Ontario's energy resource production.
Ontario's Minister of Energy, Darcy McHugh. Paul Griffin, CBC News, Toronto.
The federal government has decided not to extend the period under which illegal immigrants could seek landed immigrant status. The Minister of Immigration told the Commons today that 33 applications have been received after the period expired on October the 15th. Mr. Andrus said some were permitted for compassionate reasons, but this should not be taken as an extension. When New Democrat John Gilbert asked if illegal immigrants will now be deported, the minister said the law will be enforced.
Pablo Casals, the great Spanish composer and cellist, was buried today in San Juan, Puerto Rico, where he died yesterday at the age of 96. The high requiem mass included a performance of Casals' Song of the Birds. And the Puerto Rican Symphony played his heroic funeral march and selections from his oratorio, The Manger. The governor of Puerto Rico has proclaimed 3 days of official mourning for Pablo Casals, whom he described as a giant in music, liberty, and peace.
The national leader of social credit, Ray Alcoet, has denounced 31 Quebec priests for defending the Parti Québécois. Mr. Cowett said the priests had acted in a disgusting and shocking manner by, as he put it, cloaking the separatist and socialist policies of the Parti Québécois in their white surplices. He was referring to a signed document issued by the priests, which attacked the Quebec Créditiste leader, Yvon Dupuis, for calling the Parti Québécois communist and terrorist. Mr. Cowett said the priests had proved themselves to be more separatist and socialist than they were Christian. He said they would be better employed in working to spread the Christian doctrine than in defending what he called a whole litany of Marxists and revolutionaries.
The ceasefire in the Middle East is shattered. The fighting is as heavy as it was before yesterday's ceasefire deadline.
At the United Nations, the Security Council adopts a new resolution by the USSR and the United States.
On the battlefields, claims and counterclaims. Israel says it has spearheads within 37 miles of Cairo and that victory is almost complete.
Egypt disputes this and speaks of heavy Israeli losses.
On the northern front, the picture is the same. Fierce land and air battles.
The Soviet Union blames Israel for the ceasefire breakdown and says the situation could lead to the most serious consequences.
And Premier Mayer has a warning for Egypt. Violations would leave Israel free to act. She also demands peace talks.
First, to the Security Council meeting at the United Nations. For the second time in 48 hours, the Council has adopted another resolution calling for an end to all fighting. The resolution, co-sponsored by the Soviet Union and the United States, also calls for a return to the positions held on the war front at yesterday's ceasefire. In addition, it asks UN Secretary General Kurt Waldheim to post UN observers on the ceasefire line. The resolution was adopted 14 in favor, with China not voting. However, the meeting was not a quiet one. A shouting match broke out on the floor between the Russian, Chinese, and Israeli delegates, forcing suspension of the meeting for 10 minutes. Norman DePoe was there.
Serious disorder broke out shortly after the opening of the meeting of the United Nations Security Council this evening. The proceedings really got underway with a long speech by the Israeli ambassador, Yosef Tuka. He charged the Arabs with violating the ceasefire and therefore being responsible for continuing the Middle Eastern war. Then the floor was given to the American ambassador, John Scali, who announced that the United States and the Soviet Union were co-sponsoring a new ceasefire resolution. It says that the ceasefire should, as usual, begin at once, and that the forces should return to their positions as they were yesterday at noon when the first ceasefire was supposed to come into effect. It also called for the immediate dispatch of UN observers to the fighting fronts. Yakov Malik of the Soviet Union repeated the resolution, and then he called for an immediate vote. Well, Mr. Zhao Pongla, the Chinese foreign minister, is here in person today, and he would have none of that. He demanded the floor. This is the United Nations, he said, and not the duel of the two superpowers. He mentioned for the first time the Palestine guerrillas and offered Chinese support to what he called their sacred fight against aggression. Mr. Malik tried to make a point of order. Mr. Chow would have none of that. The Chinese have not been here very long, just under 2 years. Sometimes they are a little uncertain about procedural rules. It developed into a shouting match between Mr. Chow and Mr. Malik. Then the Israeli ambassador joined in, and there were scenes of disorder all around. The chairman, Sir Lawrence McIntyre, had to suspend the session for 10 minutes so that order could be restored. Well, order was finally restored, and Mr. Chow got the floor, and he was given the right to speak without interruption. It's a long speech. He's lecturing the two superpowers, telling them that the arms they're shipping to the Middle East are not designed really to protect either the Arabs or the Israelis against aggression. They're designed to maintain a state of no peace and no war, while the Soviets and the Americans pursue their own interests in their own spheres of influence. Norman DeFoe, CBC News, at the United Nations.
And while the debate continues, so does the fighting. A military spokesman in Cairo denies Israel's claim to have cut off Egypt's 3rd Armored Division operating in the southern sector of the canal from the main Egyptian forces. It calls the report exaggerated. On the Syrian front, it's much the same picture, as Diane Willman reports.
On the northern front, ground fighting and Israeli aerial bombing inside Syria has been going on unabated. Syria has again claimed a number of Israeli planes downed, Israeli artillery and armor losses, and Syrian villages bombed and shelled by Israeli forces. There's still no word from Damascus on Syria's attitude towards the ceasefire, and observers here say it could be a repetition of the Six-Day War when fighting along the Golan Heights simply petered out, and there was never any formal Syrian announcement. Just as there has never been any Syrian acceptance of the 1967 UN resolution on peace in the Middle East. In Damascus itself, the mood seems to be one of determination to keep the war going and disappointment that Egypt has accepted the ceasefire. Iraq, which has flatly refused the truce call, is reported to have sent more men and armor to the northern battlefront. This is Diane Willman in Beirut.
Diane says doubt and skepticism about the ceasefire appears to be growing in the Arab world. There are also reports from Jerusalem that many Israelis believe the ceasefire came a bit too soon. Michael Elkins has been covering the war on the Israeli front. He has asked if the present fighting means a serious breakdown of the ceasefire.
Well, the leading military analysts here speak of it as the normal straightening out of lines and the normal things to be expected in the beginning hours of a ceasefire. But I view that with a raised eyebrow. I don't think I can put it more strongly than that. We will see in the next few hours, I should imagine, but the straightening out of the lines and so forth may well be considerable. I don't think we can yet say it's a breakdown, complete breakdown of the ceasefire.
How strong is the feeling in Israel, though, that perhaps the ceasefire did come too early and it would have been to Israel's advantage for the war to go on for a few more days?
I think there is a considerable amount of feeling concerning that, that holds that the Israeli victory in another few days would have been not only decisive, but would have been seen to be decisive by the Egyptians, and that the awareness that the Israelis had had such a decisive victory might have served the peace a bit better than a premature ceasefire. This is not the government's view, but it is the view of a fair number of people.
But how is the ceasefire viewed from Lebanon, a non-combatant in the war? Is the fighting now putting the whole ceasefire in peril? Here's Morris Gent.
Peril, yes, I think that's a fair enough word to use. I think the superpowers will probably be able to do something about it, but it's a very dangerous situation.
Of course, the Israelis blame the Egyptians. They say the Egyptians were fighting last night, therefore they had no other course but to reply.
Well, of course, and here one can only say that in a situation like this, each side is bound to blame the other, and of course one can't seek to portion blame. The only thing, presumably, the Security Council can do is to try and send in some force pretty quickly to try and separate the combatants. I think you've got an impossible situation here in the Middle East at the moment. These people have been firing at each other for a long time. Well, quite frankly, they hate each other's guts, and you'll only get a peace if we have some kind of peace force or an agreement by the sides to withdraw a certain amount so that a peace force can come in. So I think we've got to have some kind of international force in the Middle East before we're going to get the firing stopped.
What happens if Israel makes more advances in today's fighting and what may follow? What happens, does the Security Council then try and force them back to where they were yesterday?
Well, I think this is probably what the fighting is all about. Before there is a stoppage, the Egyptians want to occupy certain ground, the Israelis want to occupy certain ground, and inevitably, whereas the two sides don't trust each other, they're still very much manoeuvring for position, and one side sees a troop movement here or there, and they think, ah, they're grouping for an attack. And if we are to have a ceasefire, we must almost have a standstill of forces, no movements behind the lines, which the other side can interpret as a possible new attack.
Morris Gent says there's only a skeleton force of UN observers, about 100 now in the Middle East, and says a much stronger body is needed to enforce the ceasefire.
And finally, to end this edition of The World at Six,
little stories for tiny folk with Uncle Max.
As the little rats jumped on the big ship, boys and girls, and swam round and round in circles in the cold water, he shouted back to the big rat, still standing on the bridge of the sinking ship, and said, "Jump, jump, big rat! All is lost! All is lost!" But the big rat simply looked over his shoulder at all the passengers running about in fright and confusion. And as his furtive little eyes darted about ferret-like at all the frightened passengers, he called back to the little rat already in the water. "Never, never will I jump, not for all the cheese in the world. They'll have to push me first." And do you know, boys and girls? And then a strange thing happened, boys and girls. As the two rats slowly sank under the cold, dark water, the big ship slowly began to rise out of the water like a huge cork. First, its funnels appeared again, and then all its decks, until it sat right up on top of the water. The engine started turning over again, and the propellers, and the big ship sailed on across the blue sea, boys and girls. All the passengers who had been so frightened and confused stood together on the deck, smiling and singing at the top of their voices.
CBC Radio Network.